This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Belgium stops evacuation flights from Kabul airport. The Netherlands and France are next to leave Afghanistan ahead of the withdrawal of American troops. Iran's president says containing the coronavirus pandemic and rising inflation are the two priorities of his newly formed government. And Russia reports 820 daily COVID-19 related deaths, the highest toll since the pandemic began in the country. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Belgium has stopped evacuating its nationals from Kabul airport as the August 31st deadline for the exit of forces and nationals of the United States and its allies looms. Belgian Prime Minister Alexander De Croo said the evacuation process has been halted in the framework of, quote, Operation Red Kite, without specifying further. Meanwhile, the Dutch government said it would stop evacuation flights from Kabul on Thursday, and France said it would also stop evacuations on Friday. This is while Western countries have warned their nationals in Afghanistan to immediately leave the surrounding of Kabul airport, citing security threats. They include the United States, Australia, and the UK. The Taliban, which took over Afghanistan on August the 15th, have already said that all foreign forces must withdraw by the end of the month, describing it as a red line. Political commentator David McBride believes Western countries have halted the evacuation of their nationals in the light of the emergence of security threats in the country.
Well, there's obviously some sort of a security warning. It could be a number of groups who want to cause chaos there. It could be ISIS, could be the Northern Alliance, who have said that they want to fight on, again, or it could be former disaffected Afghan National Army people. Ironically, it could be the people we used to be working with who now want to cause chaos. I doubt it's the Taliban. So it's interesting. I'm not sure who has lifted the threat, but we need to, it's the tables have turned, and now the Taliban, the government, even though we were fighting them until relatively recently, we are going to have to work with them as the de facto government of the country. And if that means leaving and doing what they want in regards to the airport, I guess we have to do that. The Americans have had 20 years to take people out. They failed to do so, and their allies as well. They've had a lot of time to do this. They've really been dragging their feet on it, and now it's convenient for them to sort of blame the Taliban, but they had so long to take people out.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says tackling the coronavirus pandemic and inflation are top priorities of his new government. Raisi made the comments in the first official cabinet session attended by new ministers. He stressed the importance of the rule of law and called on his cabinet members to administer justice in different fields. Iran's president also referred to the necessity of fighting corruption, saying the people should feel improvements in all spheres of society. He noted that the country's new health ministry must take a different and comprehensive approach toward containing the COVID-19 pandemic. The meeting came a day after all but one of Raisi's ministerial nominees voiced, rather received, a vote of confidence in Parliament.
After 5 days of marathon debates in Parliament over the credentials of President Raisi's cabinet choices, the final voting was held and all but one of the 19 proposed ministers won the Parliament's confidence. Parliament gave no confidence to Hossein Barghouti, the proposed education minister, with 76 votes in favor, 193 against, and 18 abstentions. In his address to Parliament, President Raisi said his cabinet will start its work as soon as the following day. He says he will not waste an hour to solve the country's problems.
After the vote of confidence is over, we will kickstart our activities with the new cabinet as of tomorrow. Our country is grappling with serious issues, and we must not waste even an hour to address them. Issues such as the fight against the coronavirus and the need to speed up nationwide vaccination will be on top of our agenda.
The ministers of defense, foreign affairs, and intelligence were among the nominees with the highest votes. Lawmakers say this signals that Parliament shares the same approach with the government over foreign policy and national security.
This is meaningful. It shows that Parliament will support the plans of the new ministers. And as the President says, the new cabinet will work throughout the day to solve the problems of the country.
Ebrahim Raisi handed his proposed cabinet lineup to Parliament 2 weeks ago, a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators then started reviewing the credentials of the proposed ministers behind closed doors for a week, and in the open sessions for the past 5 days. With just one nominee dropping out of the list, it seems that the new government will not face serious friction with Parliament in its job. Raisi now has 3 months to introduce a new name for education minister, and until then, a caretaker will be appointed to run the ministry. Yusuf Jalali from Iran's parliament.
Egypt has partially opened the Rafah border crossing with the besieged Gaza Strip. The crossing will remain open in one direction for 3 days. That's to allow stranded people to return back to the Palestinian territory. Egyptian goods and aid will also be allowed into the Strip. Egypt closed the crossing on Monday, citing security reasons following recent escalation of hostilities between Israel and Palestinians in Gaza. Rafah is a lifeline for Gazans who have been under a crippling Israeli siege since 2007, but Cairo often takes unilateral decisions to close a border point under Israeli pressure. Our correspondent in Gaza, Asher Shannon, says thousands of Palestinians have been stranded at the Rafah crossing for days without any food or shelter.
What's really happening is a humanitarian disaster on the Egyptian side of the Rafah border crossing in southern Gaza, as hundreds, maybe thousands of families are stranded inside the Sinai Peninsula, around the Sinai desert, without having a proper shelter to keep them warm or to shelter them from the sun, or have, say, running water or even bathrooms to use, and they're sleeping on the floor, they're sleeping in cardboard boxes. This is what the Egyptian authorities have been doing since Monday to the hundreds or even thousands of Palestinians who came from all over the world, coming through the Rafah crossing to visit their loved ones and to tend their the businesses in Gaza, and now they are stuck in Egypt since Monday in miserable and dire condition. Now, Egypt decided to, as of today, to reopen that Rafah crossing temporarily for 3 days to allow the entry of those stranded in Egypt.
Russia has reported the highest daily deaths from the COVID-19 since the pandemic began in the country. The health ministry says 820 more people lost their lives in the past 24 hours, pushing its death tally to nearly 180,000. Russia has the highest fatalities in Europe. Nearly 20,000 people with the COVID-19 were also identified on Thursday. Russia has been grappling with the third wave of the outbreak since mid-June. Authorities blame the resurgence on the highly contagious Delta variant. 42% of the Russian population has been fully vaccinated, but independent polls show that 55% of Russians do not plan on getting a jab. Australia has reported a record high of more than 1,000 coronavirus cases in the past 24 hours as the Delta variant continues to surge through its most populous city, Sydney. This is the first time Australia's daily infection tally goes up over 1,000 since the start of the pandemic. Most cases were detected in New South Wales state, which has turned into a virus epicenter since mid-June. The outbreak prompted lockdown in the state capital, Sydney, and then in the country's second largest city, Melbourne, as well as the federal capital, Canberra. The steep rise in cases has pushed Sydney hospitals to set up emergency outdoor tents. However, state authorities say the health system is able to cope with the new wave of infections, announcing a modest easing of restrictions for vaccinated people for mid-September. India has reported more than 46,000 coronavirus cases in the past 24 hours as the country's battle against the Delta-driven outbreaks continue. Indian Health Ministry also registered 607 deaths during the same period. Most of the cases were reported from the southern state of Kerala, where more than 30,000 infections were detected. The surge has raised concerns over a third wave of fast-spreading virus in the country. India witnessed a deadly second wave in May, prompting the government to accelerate its vaccination drive. The country has so far administered over 600 million doses. India is among the worst-hit nations, with more than 32.5 million cases and over 436,000 fatalities so far. The United States continues its aggressive stance against China. The U.S. Vice President's tour of Southeast Asia resembled more of an anti-China tour than anything else. Kamala Harris made every effort to rally nations around the region against China. This comes at a time when the world is witnessing the U.S.'s messy withdrawal from Afghanistan. But how likely is it that the nations in this region of the world want a military confrontation to happen in their own backyard?
The U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris has arrived in Vietnam as she continues a tour of Southeast Asia in an attempt to co-opt countries against China. Speaking in Hanoi on Wednesday, Harris said that there was a need to increase pressure on Beijing over its maritime claims in the South China Sea. She offered Vietnamese President's support to counter Beijing in the South China Sea. We need to find ways to raise the pressure on Beijing to abide by the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, and to challenge its bullying and excessive maritime claims. Speaking in Singapore one day earlier, Harris had said that Beijing's use of what she called scare tactics in the South China Sea continued to undermine what she described as a rules-based order and threatened the sovereignty of other regional nations. Laying out the U.S. administration's foreign policy goals, Harris reiterated that Washington had enduring interests in the Indo-Pacific region and aimed to counter Beijing's aggressive advances, as well as to maintain freedom of navigation. Harris sought to assure America's Southeast Asian allies that growing U.S.-China tensions would not force nations that have strong ties with both countries to choose one side of the political equation. She said, however, that Washington would take the side of its allies in all of their territorial disputes with China.
Our vision includes freedom of navigation, which is vital to us all. The livelihood of millions of people depend on the billions of dollars in trade that flow through these sea lanes each day. And yet, in the South China Sea, we know that Beijing continues to coerce, to intimidate, and to make claims to the vast majority of the South China Sea.
Well, we know that the United States has little to no regard for international law and regulations. As a matter of fact, a couple months ago, there was an article published about the United States Coast Guard being in the, I believe it was, Mediterranean. Now, mind you, why would the Coast Guard of the United States be in international waters unless the United States has no desire to keep international regulations and to follow international procedures?
Beijing has responded to U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris's anti-China statements with the same ferocity. It has accused Washington of refusing to join the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea while claiming to uphold the convention. It also accused the U.S. of recklessly intervening in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria under the pretext of protecting the interests of small countries.
In response to Harris's remarks, Chinese state media decried the U.S. vice president, accusing her of interfering in regional affairs by seeking to divide China and Southeast Asian nations to prevent Beijing's economic growth. China's state-run China Daily said in an editorial that while pointing a finger at China and accusing it of coercion and intimidation, Harris willfully ignored her own hypocrisy in attempting to coerce and intimidate regional countries to join Washington in a scheme to contain China. Seems that the United States' only commitment to Southeast Asia is its dedicated efforts to drive a wedge between the Southeast Asian nations and China. Meanwhile, China has accused Washington of bullying and hegemonic behavior. China's foreign ministry said that Afghanistan was one of the many examples defining what the U.S.'s so-called world order truly meant for nations.
The U.S. can come and go as it wishes and doesn't need to seek the international community's opinions, not even those of its allies. In order to defend America first, the U.S. can arbitrarily smear, suppress, coerce, and bully other countries and without paying any price. This is the order the U.S. wants.
The U.S. sees its rivalry with China as the biggest geopolitical test of the century. Southeast Asia has seen a series of high-profile visits by top U.S. administration officials, including the Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, who visited Hanoi in late July. The visits have escalated tensions between the U.S. and China, which were already high due to a range of issues ranging from cybersecurity to human rights abuses.
The United States wants to destabilize China. China is an upcoming economic superpower. Its economy in some places has already surpassed the United States. China has a growing, the most large population in the world. It is sitting on trillions and trillions of dollars worth of important resources for modern technology. It's beginning to take a lead in the space race.
The South China Sea is a gateway to major sea routes through which about $3.4 trillion worth of trade passes each year and contains huge gas fields and rich fishing grounds. China claims sovereignty over much of the strategic waterway and since 2014 has built artificial islands and reefs and installed military bases on them.
At least 20 people have died after heavy floods and mudslides ravaged Venezuela's western state of Mérida. State officials say rescue operations are underway to find 17 people still unaccounted for. They say more than 1,200 homes were destroyed and hundreds of families were affected. The floodwater also damaged phone services and electricity access in several towns. Military personnel are assisting locals in rescue efforts, but Mérida officials have called for more assistance from the central government, saying they do not have enough resources to help the affected ones. In 2005, more than 500 people died in the same region after rains overflowed rivers and caused flooding, as well as mudslides. Dozens of people have been killed in an armed attack in Nigeria's central city of Jos. Unknown assailants went on the house-to-house rampage on Tuesday night, killing residents and destroying buildings in Yelwa Zangom district. Security sources struggled to get into the area as a bridge linking the town had been destroyed by the attackers. The area has experienced ethnic clashes in the past. There's been regular fighting between the Hausa Fulani group that dominates northern Nigeria and a number of smaller local ethnic groups. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Did women also play a role in the event of Ashura, April 21st, 2010? Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her, is a prominent role model in history and shows the significance of a woman's presence in one of the most important events in human history. Blood gained a victory over the sword on the day of Ashura, and Zainab al-Kubra was the cause of that victory. This was because the forces of righteousness were apparently defeated in a military fight in Karbala, but Zainab al-Kubra's behavior was the factor that turned this apparent defeat into a permanent and decisive victory. That victory was due to the role she played after the day of Ashura. That is a very important point. The event proved that women are not on the periphery of history. It proved that women can have a central role in important historical events. This has been pointed out in several places in the Holy Quran as well. But Zainab al-Kubra is a recent example and does not belong to ancient times.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana la chan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
The story of her life is a tangible event. She played a brilliant role making the enemies, who had apparently won the battle and slain all their opponents, feel humiliated in their own base. She branded them with permanent disgrace and turned their victory into a defeat. That was what Zainab al-Kubra did. She proved that it is possible to turn feminine morality and modesty into glory and a great jihad. The greatness of Zainab al-Kubra's movement is reflected in what is left of her sermons. Her unforgettable sermon in Kufa's marketplace was not just an ordinary speech. It was not just the personal opinion of an important figure. Her sermon was a great and beautifully worded analysis of the Islamic community's situation at that time. The sermon included the most profound Islamic concepts. See how strong her character was.
As the world witnesses the developments in Afghanistan following the chaos that ensued from the abrupt U.S. withdrawal from the country, questions are being raised about Washington's war on Afghanistan and its outcome. The Taliban swept through the country at a lightning speed and managed to take control of the capital, Kabul, in less than 2 weeks. Even the Pentagon officials expressed wonder at the rate at which provincial capitals across Afghanistan fell to the militants, as the U.S. intelligence services had estimated the Afghan capital would be isolated within 30 days and overtaken 2 months after. The harrowing scenes of chaos at the Kabul airport amid the evacuation of Western citizens and troops also drew criticism against how the foreign forces pulled out of the Central Asian country. Some observers are drawing parallels between the events in Afghanistan and the U.S. retreat from Vietnam Saigon after two decades of mindless violence in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. The scenes were also reminiscent of Israel's humiliating defeat in southern Lebanon in the year 2000.
Yes, I think it's a valid comparison because both humiliating withdrawals came as a result of Western powers intervening militarily in states where they were not welcome. And they will continue to meddle militarily in the country. So I think one could say that national sovereignty and territorial integrity is not guaranteed for most of the countries of the world until finally the U.S. empire is brought down.
What do these historical events say about the U.S. and its ally Israel's influence in the West and Central Asia? The United States invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks in New York with the stated aim of fighting terrorism. It removed the Taliban from power and installed a pro-Western government in the country. Washington has also been training Afghan security forces over the years, providing more than $80 billion worth of funds to build up the Central Asian country's 300,000-strong army. It has also trained 22,000 commandos and special forces in Afghanistan to defend against security threats. However, the number of attacks in Afghanistan saw a sharp growth since Western troops were deployed to the country. Furthermore, the costly training of the soldiers turned out pointless as they quickly surrendered to the Taliban amid the militants' incursion.
The fact that the U.S. is losing around the world and that Israel is losing its grip in the Middle East is due to the fact that people are resisting in the countries of the world, and especially in the Middle East.
The drawdown of the U.S. forces from West and Central Asia can also have implications for Israel, Washington's closest ally in the region.
It's true that Israel's power relies 100% on the power of the U.S. empire. And if the U.S. empire continue, if people continue to resist successfully, and if the U.S. continues to weaken, then Israel's leaders might think about turning a new page. They might think about sharing the land with the Palestinian people, including all the refugees from around the world.
The events in Afghanistan in the past 2 weeks are going to be remembered in history books as yet another example of Western powers' failures after intervening in the affairs of countries where they are not welcome. The question is whether those actors will learn the lessons or if history will keep repeating itself.
Lately, the UN-affiliated Pan American Health Organization reported that COVID cases are accelerating in North America, driven primarily by a surge in southern and eastern United States and central Mexico. The spike is blamed on the highly infectious Delta variant of the virus. The organization stated that COVID cases in the United States are up by a third. The United States is currently the worst-hit nation in the world in terms of infections and fatalities. So, who is to blame for this situation? Last week, Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick blamed the unvaccinated African-American community for the latest COVID surge. The Lieutenant Governor's remarks drew criticism as some called his assertion baseless. The latest data from the state of Texas Department of Health Services shows the highest coronavirus case rates are among whites and Hispanics, who make up over 70% of the state's cases, not the African-Americans. Meanwhile, African Americans are more prone to the COVID-19 as they are twice as likely to die compared to their white counterparts. For instance, in the capital, Washington, D.C., African Americans account for 76% of the COVID deaths, while they make up less than half of the population. In addition, they are less likely to get vaccinated amid the variant spreads. African Americans have received smaller shares of vaccinations compared to their shares of cases and the total population. Out of the 58% of people who had received at least one dose of the vaccine, nearly two-thirds are white, and only 10% are African Americans. But COVID-19 is not the only problem they are facing. As the pandemic started last year, many working-class African Americans struggled with housing costs and faced eviction, as rent rates increased faster than their incomes. That's the best example of economic inequality in American society. Another issue that has plagued American society is racial discrimination and police brutality. According to various studies, African Americans are far more likely to be shot, arrested, and imprisoned by police than any other racial group. Many African Americans are reluctant to receive COVID jabs. This unwillingness is the result of distrust that formed after centuries of injustice toward African American communities. Vaccine hesitancy among African Americans is rooted in the historical mistreatment of the community by the U.S. government and medical institutions. One of the most horrific chapters in U.S. history is the infamous Tuskegee Experiment. In 1972, a report exposed that the U.S. Public Health Service had conducted a 40-year experiment at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama on hundreds of impoverished black men with syphilis. They were deliberately left untreated so doctors could study the disease. Many of the men died of syphilis and its complications. Some of their wives and babies were infected as well.
What was done cannot be undone, but we can end the silence. We can stop turning our heads away. We can look at you in the eye and finally say, on behalf of the American people, what the United States government did was shameful, and I am sorry.
The experiment added to the deep distrust many African Americans have toward the federal government.
Yeah, because, you know, this idea of brutality, colonial brutality, has persisted throughout the history here. I mean, I know that some people would like to talk about Tuskegee, the Tuskegee experiment that lasted for 40 years here in the United States of America from 1932 to 1972, where white people used African men as test studies for the development of syphilis in human beings. And so some people say that our distrust is, being African people's distrust is based on that kind of history. But again, African people all around the world have sense enough not to trust anything that the colonizer says is good for us, because nothing they've ever said is good for us has been.
Racism and injustice, unethical medical experiments, and slavery all have contributed to the distrust that was in making for centuries. Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, an ambitious $11 billion project that would transport natural gas from Russia directly to Germany by bypassing Ukraine. The project will double the existing Nord Stream pipeline running from Russia to Europe across the Baltic Sea, and is a sustainable way to ensure European energy security. The Nord Stream 2 project is close to completion, yet it has for long caused tensions between Moscow and Washington. The United States sees the project as a potential threat, believing that it will increase Europe's dependence on Russian gas exports and isolate Ukraine. As a matter of fact, by bypassing Ukraine, Russia and the European Union could save the transit fees that make up to 3% of Ukraine's GDP. In addition, Washington worries that Moscow's success in transferring natural gas to Europe would undermine the effectiveness of U.S. sanctions in place against the country since 2014 due to the conflict in Ukraine. On Friday, Washington slapped new sanctions on a ship and two entities involved in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project. At the same time, U.S. President Joe Biden issued an executive order allowing for sanctions to be imposed on certain Russian officials. Although this deepens the rift between the U.S. and Russia, it is unlikely to have much impact on the nearly completed energy project.
The U.S. and Germany had struck an agreement when it came to Nord Stream 2. The Biden administration waived sanctions on the company overseeing the construction of the pipeline and its chief operating officer, yet it goes ahead with sanctioning the Russian officials. It appears that the U.S. is still after sabotaging this project.
But basically, they're trying to look tough even though they're kind of surrendering, because it's clear that the Nord Stream will take place. Who is very much kind of stand to lose as a result of that is Ukraine, because, you know, Ukraine utilizing the oil pipeline, more or less 20% of their income depends on that. So Ukraine is going to lose money, and that's what the United States' interest is. They ask Germany to help. They don't want to pay themselves, so they push Germany to help Ukraine. But so that's the bottom line. But, you know, so they can sanction the Russians, but they more or less will have to agree with the Nord Stream to go on.
Britain and the U.S. both targeted seven Russians with sanctions and also issued a joint statement warning Russia over chemical weapons. The targeted Russian individuals are described as Russian security officials allegedly involved in a nerve attack on Navalny last year. This is while Moscow has denied any involvement in the incident. Washington separately imposed sanctions on another two men and four Russian institutes it said were involved in chemical weapons research or what it described as an assassination attempt against Navalny. Navalny was poisoned using a nerve agent. He was flown to Germany for medical treatment after falling ill in Siberia on August 20th last year. Though he survived, he was arrested in January when he returned to Russia. The U.S. has been on the forefront with anti-Russia rhetoric over Navalny's case, including his alleged poisoning. This is while Kremlin has said it will not allow any foreign interference in its domestic affairs. In response to the latest round of sanctions over Nord Stream 2 and the Navalny case, Russian Foreign Ministry condemned the measures as unilateral and illegitimate, vowing that Moscow's response to sanctions will be tough and appropriate.
The developments in Afghanistan have been making headlines for the past few days following the chaos that ensued the abrupt U.S. troops withdrawal from the country. The Taliban's meteoric rise to power and pandemonium at the Kabul airport prompted criticisms against how the U.S. pulled out its troops and also the outcome of the 20-year war on Afghanistan. Western politicians were among those expressing regret over incidents in Afghanistan, with German Chancellor Angela Merkel saying it appeared that all the troops killed in the war had died in vain. But that's not the only bitter legacy of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan. Russia's Security Council Secretary Nikolai Petrushev has said that Washington turned the Central Asian country into a global illicit drug laboratory in the past 20 years. In an interview, the Russian security chief noted that the production of opiates in Afghanistan have increased over 40-fold during the past two decades.
Well, obviously, a lot of this was being produced during the time that the United States and the NATO forces were active in Afghanistan. And there was really never a concerted effort. There were attempts every now and then, you know, to do destroy fields and to, you know, persuade the farmers to produce, you know, corn or wheat or something like that. But it was not very successful, and it was never really a concerted effort on the part of the authorities to do that.
The Russian official added that the war crippled Afghanistan's economy, throwing it back decades. The United States has been training Afghan government forces for the past 20 years. Out of 300,000 Afghan troops, 22,000 have been commandos that Washington says have received special training. Despite that, the Taliban managed to sweep through the nation in a matter of days and seize the capital Kabul faster than anybody had anticipated. The rapid rate at which Afghan cities fell to the militant group also stunned Pentagon officials.
They had
the training, the size, the capability to defend their country. This comes down to an issue of will and leadership. And no, I did not, nor did anyone else, see a collapse of an army that size in 11 days.
According to Russia's security chief, Nikolai Petrushev, the West was never able to train the army, police, and security services of Afghanistan, as the number of attacks in Afghanistan have increased significantly after foreign forces were deployed to the country.
The Taliban, during the course of the time the United States was so-called in charge in Afghanistan, and really they controlled only a small part of the country. They were never in control of the entire country. Much of this, much of the Taliban influence was still making itself felt in various parts, especially in the region, some of the mountainous regions that often were inaccessible to large-scale military intervention. And the fact that that was an ongoing fight in which the Taliban were pitted against the official Afghani forces, then it seems reasonable that these would increase to the extent that they still felt themselves at war with a foreign power.
Petrushev added that the reported 40,000 civilian deaths since 2001 in Afghanistan has been understated, and that the figure doesn't include tens of thousands of Afghan troops that have been killed over the years. The Russian security official concluded that the staggering number of deaths is a result of the U.S. interference in the domestic affairs of other countries.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Ayatollah Ahmadi Mianaji Rahmatullah Alayh searched about the books
that have been compiled or written regarding the figure and personality of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and he found that this approach is missed and has not been done by any researcher.
When late Ayatollah Mianeji reaches to the figures, historical figures and Islamic figures, selectively he presents a very enriched information about it.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher you're listening to. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two experts from the Islamic House of Qom, two scholars, Sheikh Ali Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyainia. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyainia, assalamu alaikum, brother, we're welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Since we are still in the holy month of Muharram, we want to dedicate our program, The Teacher, as usual, to one of the scholars who spend or dedicate, it's better to say, one of his scholarly efforts or books to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Of course, he himself is a scholar of high caliber regarding the religious studies and the Shia studies. He is no one but the late Ayatollah Mirza Ali Ahmadi Mianeji, one of the most outstanding, maybe say, faqih, the Shia faqih, the contemporary one, the student of Allama Tabatabai, and one of the outstanding teachers of akhlaq or ethics in the Islamic House of Qom. Sheikh Ziyainia, let's start with you, brother. What introductory remarks do you have regarding the late Ayatollah Mirza Ali Ahmadi Mianeji?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. About the figure that today we want to talk about him, I mean Ayatollah Ahmadi Mianeji rahmatullah alayhi, we should mention that he was born in Miane, a city near Tabriz in Iran.
That's right.
And he started his studying in the city of Miane. And then after some years, he moved to Tabriz because of the suggestion of one of his teachers. And then he didn't stay that much in Tabriz. Mm-hmm. He moved from Tabriz to Qom after less than a year.
Okay.
Of course, in Tabriz, he got familiar with the personality of late Allama Tawatabai, rahmatullah alayhi. And he went to his house and introduced himself with the letter that one of his teachers in Miana has written and given to him, mm-hmm, to introduce him, this Ayatollah Ahmadi Mianeji, to introduce him to Allama Tawatabai as a beginner or intermediate student in Hausa.
So Mianeji comes from the word Miana, I think.
Yeah,
that's right. Okay, I didn't know that, the place that he was born. And this was a habit of introducing a student to a teacher through a letter or a jaza or something?
Yes. Uh-huh. If, for example, a student wants to move to another city to study there especially, it was a norm that the teachers that he had previously, his previous teachers, would give him a permission or a letter or something like that to introduce him to scholars in the new city.
Very much similar to the letter of recommendation that today is the professor.
Yes, exactly. Okay, exactly. Okay,
very good.
And another point is that after finishing the study, it was also a norm that the teachers who had taught to, mm-hmm, this figure or any student,
that's right,
would give him a certificate.
Oh.
Something like ijaza.
Ijaza says, yes, a permission. So ijtihad ijaza, okay.
Ayatollah Ahmadi Mianeji took a permission or recommendation letter from one of his teachers in Miana and went to Tabriz, gave that letter to late Allama, and he studied with Allama Tawatawi in Tabriz, but very short period of time.
That's right.
Then he moved to Qom, and at the same year, Allama Tawatawai also moved to Qom.
That's all right.
And here is the point that Ayatollah Ahmadi Mianeji is getting more familiar with the figure of Allama Tawatawai. And Allama Tawatawai is also welcoming him more.
Mm-hmm. And you know, this eagerness among the students to go and follow a teacher or trainer or ustad, as we say, is very important, especially when we are talking about the religious topics or the ethical, the akhlaqi one, you know. The presence of a muallim or a teacher is important. Sheikh Mahdawi, let's get to you, brother. Nice introduction by Sheikh Ziaynia about the birthplace of Ayatollah Ahmadi Mianeji. What more information do we have about the scholarly life of Ayatollah Ahmadi Mianeji?
A'udhu min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. To add top of what my brother mentioned with respect to the ethics and morality and being famous as a ustad akhlaq, or the scholar who is teaching akhlaq, I think there is one point that must be mentioned. In Hausa, we have different levels for the scholar to move on. When he starts as a student, after a period of time, he starts teaching the same thing that he get the lessons. So after 6 years, he moves to the second level. When he starts more complicated books called Rasa'il Makasid. And after this period of time, he moves to another level, teaching kifaye and other stuff. After that, they start teaching darse akhlaq. That is the beginning of reaching the point of marja'iyya.
That's right.
So it gives a very good picture if you start teaching darse kharij.
Okay.
This is the last level of house.
Or the advanced levels, yes, of house studies.
For late Ayatollah Mianeji, when we are saying that he was the ustad akhlaq, we have to look at his lifestyle, even Hausavi lifestyle.
Very good.
Because that is not a bad thing for a scholar to start teaching darst akhlaq if he has reached in terms of knowledge. He is capable of teaching those things.
Very good.
But with respect to late Ayatollah Mianeji, we see that although several times he had taught Rasa'il, Makasib, Kifayeh, two levels behind Darsa Kharij,
that's
or
right,
the advanced level of Hauze.
Right.
And there was a kind of need from the Tulab and students that we want to continue with you, Darsa
right,
Kharij, but he held back.
That's
he
right,
didn't continue,
okay,
saying, I don't want to enter this level.
That's right.
People are interpreting this thing as
okay,
a kind of being moral person.
Mm-hmm.
He does not see himself at the position that, okay, if I enter that level, maybe with respect to knowledge,
that's
I am
right,
okay.
Yes.
But I'm not sure about the other temptation that will come through the shaitan. This is not
that's
to blame
right,
anybody.
Okay. Yes.
As I said,
yes,
that is a kind of normal custom and
yes,
normal habit among scholars of the Hauze.
That's all right.
But if somebody at this level of knowledge,
mm-hmm,
he holds back. He does not enter that level, which is the last level, which might end up with marja'iyya, which
that's
is a
right,
very big position
okay,
in Hausa studies.
Mm-hmm.
He holds back.
That's all right.
And in his memories or memories regarding the lifestyle of late Ayatollah Mianeji, this point has been mentioned as a kind of implementation of akhlaq in his Hausafi lifestyle.
It's very good because sometimes, you know, we take akhlaq and this specific field of ethical trainings something as granted, because we see that, okay, this is the akhlaqi one and lifestyle one, this is a general one. But I myself think that the ethical training needs some expertise. And, you know, beside the ahkam and aqaid, which are very important in the Hausa studies, we have to consider this akhlaqi level too. And this point is very important. Although Ayatollah Ahmadi Mianeji was a master in terms of fiqh and usul, but still he prefers to teach akhlaq.
Yeah.
And this makes him, I think, a greater personality. Okay?
That's okay, this is with respect to the
yes,
issue of akhlaq.
Yes.
And also with regard to the point, his lifestyle, we see that the place that he has chosen for his life, it was a downtown in Qom, which is called Khak Faraj. If people
yes,
are familiar with the map of Qom, they know
yes,
where this location is located exactly. It's not considered upper level, upper
no, it's not,
area in Qom. So till the end of his life, although people or his followers were making this request that we have prepared some other places for you, that area is not fitting your position.
Yes.
You as a scholar of Hausa, it's mm-hmm. better to come at least to be next to the masjid, because he was leading the salat in masjid, which is known as Masjid Abdullahi, next to the Badar.
That's
that
right.
is also one of the downtown areas.
Yes.
It's actually the area that he was delivering mm-hmm. his akhlaqi speeches. And another point with the masjid, the spirit of people who would go to
yes.
that masjid.
The simple lifestyle that this ulama had, and being among the people, you know.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the lifestyle of some of the Muslim scholars is changed nowadays. But I do want to say, in the past, we used to see the religious maraja and ulama among the people more. And the lifestyle, I think, used to be more simpler than what they are today. Especially, as you said, living in the downtown or simple places or going. And even, you know, during the war of Iraq, imposed war of Iraq, Ayatollah Ahmadi Mianaji was one of the ulama who was present among the Iranian soldiers over there. One of his sons, I think, is got martyred too.
Yes.
And going over there and giving akhlaqi lectures to the soldiers or troops over there. These all show that he believed in religion in the applied sense of the word, not the theoretical one.
Yeah,
and this makes him very important. That's right, Sheikh Mahdavi. Sheikh Ziyaniya, more information can you give us about the lifestyle of the late Ayatollah Ahmadi Mianaji? Okay, to add some more points regarding the lifestyle of late Ayatollah Ahmadi Mianaji, it's necessary to mention these points that because he was a teacher in ethics,
yes,
many of the tulab or beginners in the seminary school, they would refer to him
mm-hmm.
and ask him about some suggestions,
that's right.
some advices regarding ethics.
Yes.
You know, he knew that these students want somehow prescription
yes.
to move the way that is for during 2 years, 3 years,
yes.
or 5 years during one night.
Okay.
So he just... in these moments
to make a long way short
yeah.
and giving them a short prescription,
you know,
okay.
they were trying to find a shortcut
that's
to
right okay.
move fast and to just go to the point.
This is usually the case about all the people,
yes.
not only the Hausa students, okay.
And Ayatollah Ahmadi Mianaji rahmatullah alayh was an experienced
yes.
teacher,
okay.
so he knew what is the story.
Yes.
At these moments he used to suggest these beginners in Hausa that if you want to be a pious person,
yes.
first of all, try to avoid Muharramat, these
forbidden ones, the banned
yeah,
ones.
Forbidden
okay.
ones. And second, try to perform wajibat and necessary ahkam in your life.
The obligations, the
yeah.
obligatory ones, that's right.
Third, eat enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't need to, you know, decrease your food and try fasting every day. No.
Okay.
Eat enough
mm-hmm.
and sleep enough.
Okay.
You need these two. And at the end, the fifth injunction that he used to mention for these students was that your most necessary mission during your studying is to study very well.
Mm,
do
right.
not forget about this one.
Yes.
And at the end, he used to say, then if you had some enough time, you may perform some mustahabbat and recommendations that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has put upon the shoulders
okay.
of mu'minin. So maybe it comes to our mind that if somebody is a teacher of ethics
yes.
or akhlaq, he always tries to give, you know, structures.
Some specific
yeah.
formulas
yeah, yeah.
to go or zikrs to
yeah.
repeat, to be repeated, but not.
But this was not the case.
Okay.
This
That's
was
right.
not the case. And
mm-hmm.
I believe that his method...
Mm-hmm.
was famous amongst tulab, because
yeah.
they are also some other teachers for
yes.
akhlaq, but amongst tulab, marhum Ayatollah Ahmadi Mianaji was very well known and famous.
That's all right.
May Allah bless him. And
may Allah bless you. So this is really great. As you said, when we refer to some of the akhlaqi or spiritual, we can say teachers, sometimes we are waiting. This story has also been repeated about the late Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Ghazi Tabatabai.